Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cinema Theology. I am one of your co-hosts. My name is Josias Flores, and of course, I am joined here by our other co-host, which is...
Hadid Cortez. It's so good to be back here talking about movies. So what are we talking about today, Josias?
We are talking about one of the movies that I was pleasantly surprised by when I first saw it. I had heard about it, didn't think much of it. And then I watched it and I was like, wow, okay, I see what the hype is about, at least the hype in my circles. The movie, of course, that we're talking about is My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Great.
Tell us more about this movie, dude.
So, yeah, I think you and I kind of dared ourselves to do a romantic comedy. And I think, I don't know what your relationship is with romantic comedies, but for me, it's not a particular genre that I like to watch a lot. But I think this is actually a gem in that genre, and I really like it as well. So My Big Fat Greek Wedding is about this woman, her name is Tula or Fotula Portokalos, who, of course, is Greek. She has a Greek family, grew up under strict Greek values, this great sense of Greek nationalism as well. And her parents expect her to do just as every other Greek woman, to get married and have children and make great food. But the whole thing changes when she meets Ian Miller in Chicago, Illinois. She falls in love with him and she wants to get married to him, to the dismay of her family. And let me just say that I just mentioned the parents, but she also has brother and thousands of cousins as well. So
thousands. Oh my gosh.
She has a big, big family. And I think most of the comedy actually comes from the clash of cultures between Tula's family and Ian, and also Ian's family. And it makes for some great, hilarious things that happen. So that's the synopsis of it. I think it's a little bit different from other romantic comedies where the drama doesn't really come from the romance itself. It comes more from the situations and the culture around it. So as I said, we kind of did this on a dare. We wanted to do something different that's not historical or science fiction-y. So we did a romantic comedy. And one of the things I found interesting about this movie is that it was actually made by a Canadian-American woman who kind of based the story around her own life experience. And I think that makes it feel a little bit more genuine. And you can really see that in the film. So what do you think about this movie, Josias?
Yeah, it's a great description there, Dido. I like that. And right on. There's a deep connection that I have to this movie, not just because of, you know, just the history with me and the movie specifically, but I just recently got married. I studied family studies, so I've been looking at issues of culture and marriage when it comes to those kind of things, and also throwing in religion in there, which is part of the movie as well. And then also, I understand what it's like to be part of an immigrant family that has maybe different values, cultural values, than the country that you're living in. So on multiple levels, I feel like I relate to this movie. I don't understand, you know, the female perspective, being a male myself. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that I'm like, even if the Greek culture is different from my own Venezuelan culture. So I like the movie. I enjoy watching it. And I think you're right. Most of the humor and the drama comes from the culture clashes and the cultural maybe uniqueness and those idiosyncrasies, rather than the drama of the romance and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think it's a great movie. What about you, Dido? Beyond the synopsis, what do you think about this movie?
So I really enjoyed it. I saw it a long, long time ago. This movie is from 2002, so it's old by, I guess, today's standards. But I remember I saw it a long, long time ago, and I thought, okay, so if we're going to do a romantic comedy, I remember this being pretty funny and having some substance to it as well. So I thought it would be interesting. And I was, as you say, pleasantly surprised that it really holds up even to today. I actually saw it with my fiancé. And there's a lot of relevant stuff, and, you know, for planning weddings and so on and so forth, you kind of relate to as a person who is kind of in this process right now. So I really enjoyed it as well. So today I thought we might put you today a little bit more on the spot because, of course, you are the recently married of the two of us, and you also have a background right. in family studies. So I think you can say a little bit more on relationships and all this different stuff. But that doesn't mean that I'm going to be totally silent. I do have some stuff that I would like to bring up in this movie, and I would like to start off with the following theme. The traditional Greek Orthodox family that Tula comes from places a great deal of importance on being married, in the sense that they expect women to complete three functions: get married, have babies, and feed them, as she describes.
And specifically, marry Greek boys, make Greek babies, and feed everyone. So the Greek part is important.
The Greek part is very, very important, as you learn throughout the movie. I would just want to touch on the following question. What does the Bible expect of man and women in terms of marriage? Because, of course, in Genesis 2, when God creates mankind, he sees Adam and he says, it is not good that man should be alone. And so he creates Eve. And so we kind of get this idea that man is created to have, you know, to be together with his spouse, and a woman is created to be with her husband as well. But then if we look further into the Bible, specifically in the New Testament, I'm looking here from 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where the Apostle Paul is writing the following things. Now to the unmarried and the widows I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do, but they cannot control themselves. They should marry, for it is better to marry a man than to burn with passion. So I want your take on this, Josias. We have two verses that are apparently at odds with each other. One saying it is not good for men to be alone. The other one saying if you're single, then stay single unless you have burning passions. How do we kind of reconciliate these two concepts in Scripture?
Yeah, good point. I think there's a big clarification that needs to happen in order to truly understand the coherence between these two texts that you brought up. And it's the fact that in Genesis, well, at least in my interpretation, when we read it's not good for man to be alone, a lot of times we read into that it is not good for man to be unmarried. And so we believe that somehow we're supposed to, in order to achieve fulfillment in life as a human being, really, like we need to be married. And I think we've taken that idea and put a lot of pressure on people mm-hmm. with it. But that's not necessarily what the Bible means. I mean, the Bible has examples, and Jesus himself talks about people who choose to be eunuchs, right? Which means they're going to live a celibate lifestyle. They're not going to be married. Jesus himself did not marry on the biblical account. We also have Paul, who decided not to marry, and he said that he wished other people were like him because he could devote all his time to ministry. But he says, I understand if you have sexual desires and instead of burning with passion and sinning, find a wife or find a husband and get married. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to qualify that, yes, there is a principle of human nature that we need other people in order to thrive. And we see psychology and we see studies from the scientific side of things that kind of corroborate this idea, you know, that social interactions, even physical touch, is very important in development. However, to say that marriage is necessary for the human experience, I think is short-sighted and limiting the whole of biblical narrative based on that text. So that's kind of how I interact with that. And so if you are single, don't feel like, hey, I need to be married in order to be fulfilled or in order to have significance. That is definitely not the case. As a matter of fact, I would believe that you need to learn how to be happy as a single person before you become a happy married person. Otherwise, you're going to carry those things into a marriage, and mm-hmm. that just amplifies problems. So, yeah, if you're single and you feel God has called you to be single, that is completely okay. Yeah. And that's biblically supported.
I think it's very important to say, because I think especially in the circles that I've been in, there comes when you get to a certain point in life, there's as people start to ask you, so when are you getting married? When are you going to find someone? When are you going to have babies? Yep. All these different things, which makes you think sometimes that the value of your life hinges on whether you find a partner or a suitable partner or not. But I like that you said the following thing, that that's not the point by which our life hangs in the balance. Mm-hmm. It's some people are called to be married. Some others, God calls to, you know, be celibate, to be single, and all the better for them. There is no shame in that as well.
Yeah, and honestly, I just want to say historically, you know, mm-hmm. with pastors, and we're both pastors, they have been put under the pressure of you need to be married in order to be a minister, which it's interesting because throughout Christian history, you have different ideas on that, right? You have Paul who wasn't, and then you have monks who very clearly weren't in the Catholic clergy. And then we were in a system that not that long ago, in order to be ordained in certain places, you needed to be married. So to me, I find that fascinating that we've kind of, as a Christian church, not just Adventist church, but Christian church as a whole throughout history, we've kind of had different ideas on marriage and clergy and so on and so forth. So I definitely think it's important to make that distinction and to affirm our single brothers and sisters.
Definitely. So yes, what is something I before we began this podcast, you mentioned you wanted to talk about some other issues, and you being the expert on relationships here. What are some of the things that spoke to you?
I will not go that far. No, I am no expert. I am learning so much, and I have so much more to learn. So please, if you have wisdom, impart it with us. One of the things that stood out to me is this idea of expectations and also, cultural expectations and how they affect us, right? So, anyway... I'll start it this way. I had a professor at Andrews who was a mentor and a boss for me and a professor. His thesis in family studies, he had a doctorate in family studies, was about gender roles in marriages, specifically Romanian marriages that in couples that came to the United States. And so he kind of saw the expectations that they had in Romania and the expectations of the culture here in the United States and how that affected their marriage. And so he really went into this fascinating study about the place of culture and religion. Because a lot of times, a lot of these couples were religious couples and they would use the Bible as a way to try to fight for the cultural values that they held before they came to the United States. But what ended up happening was when they came to the United States, a lot of these wives saw the different kind of mentality, even among Christian circles here in the United States. And they said, we don't have to live by these values anymore. But the men were not ready to give that up. And a lot of times they ended up in divorce, which is kind of sad, actually. But that's another conversation as to divorce. So I just find that really fascinating. And that put me on a track to really think about how much of our lifestyle as Christians is hinging on biblical principles and how much of it hinges on cultural values. Because the more I look into it, the more I realize that missionaries, when they went and preached the gospel to other parts of the world from usually Western countries, they brought not only the Bible and its principles, but also their interpretations of those principles into their culture. So I'll give you an example. In Hawaii, when the missionaries got to Hawaii, they saw a people group, and especially the women that were, not clothed as much as the Victorian women were clothed, right? And so they saw that as immodest. And in this, hot climate that is the tropical islands of Hawaii, they decided to bring the Victorian era type of dress into the culture. And they believed that was part of the, the values, the Christian values that they needed to impart. And so basically you end up with a group of ladies who are really hot because they're wearing something that is not practical for the place they're living in, but they're trying to live a Christian lifestyle. So just this fascinating idea of mixing the culture and mixing religion, and that we see that in this movie, right? Because they believe, it seems like from what is portrayed in this movie, the Greeks, like you have to be, the Greek Orthodox, you have to be married in their church. The ceremony has to happen a certain way. You need to be baptized before you get married, so on and so forth. So that's my whole thing is, if you're listening to this, I just want you to think through what are some things that I do if I do consider myself a Christian that I do that I think are based on my beliefs that are really based on my culture? And analyze your lifestyle through the lens of culture because I think that can be beneficial when we address other cultures and when we try to have these multicultural conversations. I don't know. What do you think about this, Dilo?
No, I think you're definitely right about that. I think one of the Where the gender roles kind of comes into play in this film specifically is when the mom says the following, is that the man is the head of the household, but the woman is the neck because she turns the head whichever way she wants. So I thought it was an interesting yes. way of describing kind of like their gender roles and what are the expectations for women, what are the expectations for men. And one of the things I found in this movie is like, you see this theme where kind of the men are like hard-headed, they're very dogmatic, and the women are more sensible, they're more supportive of their daughters, and they kind of don't really stand up to them, and they kind of like subtly manipulate them. So I'm not sure how do you interpret that?
Yeah, wow, that's a fascinating conversation too. And shout out to my beautiful wife Chelsea, because that's her favorite line from this movie, the neck idea. So that's an idea that comes from the Bible, and I think it's been misinterpreted. And it's found in Ephesians chapter 5. And these are conversations that I've had with others, but I'm still like learning. So please bear with me. And again, it's a conversation, a dialogue, not a one-sided statement, so to speak. So Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22, it's where people really focus the most. And it says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife," continues verse 23, "as also Christ is the head of the church, and he is the savior of the body." Now, a lot of people read that and they say, oh, see, there you go. The men is supposed to be the head of the house and women are supposed to submit. And so in that word submission, a lot of people have read, you have to do exactly what I say, right? Like, I have control over you and you don't have as much agency. And I think that's been misguided. And so, first of all, I want to point out to verse 21 that says, submitting to one another in the fear of God. He's talking to the church, right? And in Ephesus, and he's talking about how everyone needs to submit to one another. So the submission does not go one way. It's not one directional. It's multi-directional. Everyone needs to submit to one another. Also, I want to point out verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself to her, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word." So I just want to, if the example for husbands is to be to the wives the way that Jesus treats the church, that goes so much deeper than what I think has been emphasized for some time in a lot of different circles and some cultures. Because if we are to live the way that Christ lived for the church, that means we have to live as husbands very self-sacrificial lives, because that's what Jesus did. When we look at Philippians chapter 2, right? It says that he did not, and we talked about this in the conversation about just mercy. He did not hold equality with God as something to be grasped with, but he actually gave himself. He emptied himself, the kenosis in the Greek, in order to, you know, give, basically bring life to the church. And so as a husband, that tells me so much more, that like the respect and the submission that, you know, my wife should have for me is rooted in this self-sacrificing love that, you know, takes the example of Jesus Christ, you know? And the problem is when we as husbands don't become examples of this kind of love, of this kind of self-sacrifice, and expect the submission, obviously we're going to get pushback, and then it creates really dysfunctional families. And then we're expecting the wife to be the one who has to put up with it. And we, a lot of times, fall into spiritual abuse because we don't see this kind of one-sided picture of what marriage should be like. So anyway, that's kind of my take on it. And I can talk more about headship. Also want to talk about the fact that ultimately Christ is the head of the church. Both men and women are part of the church. Christ is the one who should be leading a marriage. And as such, needs to be the third and most important aspect of the marriage in order for a marriage to succeed. Anyway, that's some of my take on it. What do you think, Dido? I don't want to talk this whole episode.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely correct. And because a lot of people take that to mean, okay, so only men can be leaders, only men can have a say in what happens in the family. But in reality, what Jesus is trying to exemplify to all of us, and what it says in scripture, is that we should all be willing to submit to each other, to become servants to each other, just as Christ was a servant to us, even though he was the last person like in the universe that should have submitted to another person. But he chose to do that. And so we are to take that example. So I really like that you said that. And one of the things that I comes into play in the film, which I find really interesting, is that you might expect the film to take on the side of kind of stand in opposition to the cultural values and the ideology of the family, of the Greek Orthodox, you know, way of I don't know, just the culture. But it, by the end, you feel like it has some criticisms about it, but it also kind of embraces it. It kind of it differentiates what are some of the, you know, less rational and more inconvenient aspects of this culture, but what are some also the pros, in the sense that you kind of see like the family, even though they are kind of overbearing sometimes, even though they are loud, whatever you say, they're very, very loved. They're very united. And one of the things she says at the end, that she knows that whatever happens, her family is there for her. So I think that's also a place to how we kind of approach film as well. You and me, we kind of see, okay, what are some of the positive aspects that we can take out of this film, and what are some of the negative aspects that we can kind of do without as well, about what these films are saying. I think that's a healthy approach to culture as well. And you talked about differentiating between biblical values and cultural values, and I think that's a very good exercise to do, because just because something is a cultural value doesn't mean that you should completely do away with it. Some of those cultural values are very good. They serve a purpose, and you know, that you can keep them, and they're totally fine. We just shouldn't really confuse them with biblical law, if you get what I mean. But it is something's yes. very good for us to continue to have these cultural values, because they could just keep families united. They keep us, you know, they form a part of our identity as well. So I really like that aspect of the film as well. Another theme, or something else that I was thinking about while watching this movie, I was thinking about the story of Isaac and Rebecca. Because we know in Genesis, yes,
fascinating.
When Isaac is of age to marry, Abraham is really, really worried because he doesn't want Isaac to be married to a Canaanite woman. He sends his servant to go look for a wife for Isaac. And of course, he goes, he finds the house of Laban, and he's kind of struck with Rebecca. So he comes and brings her back for Isaac. And I was thinking, that's kind of, you could kind of see the parallels between what Abraham did there and what the family in this movie is trying to do with Tula as well, in the sense that they don't want their daughter to marry outside of the cultural values that they possess. And so you kind of see this whole section in the movie where the parents are parading this long list of Greek Orthodox boys for her to kind of, I don't know, flirt with, or you know, see a possibility in marriage there. So I was thinking, how does it apply to us as Christians? Because of course, a lot of part of our culture is that we also desire to look for other Christians when we're looking for a potential partner. And I think we also find a lot of people use the following verse as kind of a point to support this, where it says in 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14, "Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers, for what partnership can righteousness have with wickedness, or what fellowship does light have with darkness?" So my question here is, for us Christians, do we take this verse in the sense that it is perhaps a sin for us to marry outside of our denomination, of our Christian values? What do you think this says about that?
Yeah, good. So 2 Corinthians 6:14, I just want to emphasize from the get-go, this is talking about beliefs, right? It's talking about your religious beliefs. It's not talking about cultural or ethnic backgrounds. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because a lot of times throughout history, people have used this verse to excuse their notion that people should marry within their own ethnic groups. Okay. And so I think this needs to be dispelled, because this is not what Paul is saying right here. He's very specifically talking about believers and unbelievers. So I just want to make that clarification from the get-go. I'm part of an interracial marriage as well. So I just want to affirm that. Anyway, having said that, I think there is a principle here. And again, going back to my mentor and professor, Dr. Romulus Kelvajon, who I mentioned previously, I had a conversation with him about this. And, you know, he told me this, honestly, any two people can work it out in marriage. And I thought that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. He said, for some people, it will be harder than others, you know, to make it work. But if two people are willing to work at it, they can make a marriage work. He said, having said that, he clarified that what ends up happening is there are factors that make this, I guess, attempt at making things work in a marriage more difficult. And among those factors, even outside of the biblical counsel, but from the scientific perspective or the perspective of the field, one of the hardest hurdles to overcome, if not the hardest, is different religious beliefs, right? And so he says, the reason why, from a non-religious perspective, this is important is because in order to make marriages work, this is one of the hardest hurdles to overcome. So I thought that was fascinating. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, culture plays into that as well, but that is not as big of a hurdle to overcome. You know, maybe education levels is another factor that can affect. Again, it's not impossible to overcome. And he mentioned a few other things. But I thought that was fascinating from his perspective as a family studies professor, that this is like the hardest hurdle to compatibility to overcome. And I think it's why. So for me, from both areas, from a religious perspective, from a, you know, biblical rather perspective, and then from the scientific perspective, this makes sense not to be yoked with unbelievers, right? And then there's anecdotal mm-hmm. evidence too that I could talk about. And of course, there are exceptions. There are marriages that, you know, a believer, a Christian is married to a non-Christian, or a Christian from an Adventist denomination is married to another denomination, and they seem to work things out. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying that God can't work with those couples. As a matter of fact, Paul has counsel to those couples as well, and saying, hey, don't divorce someone if they believe differently from you. That's not okay either. But at the same time, I believe that this is counsel that's going to help individuals in their life and in their marriages. So
definitely.
Anyway,
so
that's kind of my take on it. I'm not sure if I've been clear enough, and maybe there are gray areas that you as a listener can nitpick, and that is okay. But that's kind of where I stand and my understanding of this is. Dido, what do you think?
So the way I interpret this verse is particularly is that it's not particularly a sin to marry outside of the faith, but it, of course, as in everything, God wants us to live happy and fulfilling lives. And he knows, as yes. you mentioned, that if there is the obstacle of different beliefs, religious beliefs, it will make life a lot harder for those two people. So in a sense, it's simply God's way of telling us it's wiser, it's much easier, it's more fulfilling to have a partner who agrees with you on these different religious ideas if they believe the same things that you believe. Because mm-hmm. let us also not run into the other extreme that we marry anybody who is of our denomination, of our beliefs, because that right. may also turn out to be terrible as well. I've known so many examples of marriages that were of people who followed the same denomination, but there were problems of abuse, they ended in divorce, and different reasons for why these marriages didn't work out. So let us not also fall into the trap of believing that only because we are of the same faith, we're both Protestant, we're both Seventh-day Adventist, before we were both Methodist, that's why it's going to work. No, there are so many different layers yes. to how marriage works, and in this verse of being equally yoked is just God's way of telling us, okay, this will make life so much better for you, and it just make your faith that much stronger.
Adi, thank you so much for bringing that out and clarifying that. That's so important. And that takes me back to the image we found in that verse, 2 Corinthians 6:14, do not be unequally yoked. So when we talk about a yoke, it's not an image that we see anymore. Really, I guess the closest maybe image that we could think of that's still pretty close to what this means is like a horse-drawn carriage, mm-hmm. right? where you have two horses, and ideally you want two horses of equal size, equal strength, pulling in the same direction in order to move the carriage along in the direction that needs to be moved to. You know, when you have two horses that are trying to pull in different directions, that's chaos, and you don't get to the place that you need to go. You see that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the yoke back in the day. If you had two oxen yoked up, and one of them wanted to go to the right side of the field, the other one to the left side of the field, you weren't going to go anywhere. It's going to be disaster. Mm-hmm. And so it's so important, because the imagery is, you guys have to be aiming in a similar direction. Your goals need to somehow line up and try to go towards similar things in order to have the best kind of success in your marriage. The reality is, even among your denomination, it may be individuals that have different ideas and are pulling in different directions and may still be unequally yoked with you, because just their life goals are different. And so it's important to keep that in mind as well, that the imagery here is, hey, you need two people pulling in the same direction, equally yoked, so that you can get something done as a couple, as a marriage, and experience some of that success instead of trying to fumble around for a long time and trying to figure things out. Anyway, that's my take on that.
Definitely. And just to clarify again, we are not experts on relationships here. We're just expressing our own views or our own opinions. Yes. So you can definitely disagree with us on this, and we're totally open to hearing you. And I think it's an interesting conversation to have. Wouldn't you agree?
Definitely. Oh man, I love these conversations. That's part of the reason why I studied some of this in college. So just to clarify to the listener, I was going for a family studies major. That didn't work out, so I just ended up getting a minor. So I definitely am not, by any stretch of the imagination, an expert on this field. I just have a little bit of background, and that's it.
I feel like, in a sense, we have kind of risen to the challenge here of analyzing a romantic comedy. Because I know when we started on this, I was thinking I was going to be grasping for straws for things to analyze. But, you know, there's value to be found in a lot of things that we perhaps don't really think about. Hmm. And I enjoyed this. Is there anything else you want to touch upon here?
I just briefly want to talk about expectations, because a lot of times, one of the things that I've noticed and that I've read also that causes problems in relationships are unmet expectations or unspoken expectations that aren't met. And so then it causes a lot of frustration. I'll give you an example. Let's say that every year, Dido, for your birthday, your parents, you know, sang you happy birthday while you were just waking up and then brought you breakfast in bed, right? And so you get married and you've never told your future wife about this. And so what ends up happening on your birthday, as you're waking up, you're expecting, you know, the birthday song, you're expecting this breakfast in bed, and none of that happens. And so then your first interactions with your now wife are a frustration because you had unmet expectations. You see what I'm saying? And I think the movie touches on this. You know, the family had all these expectations of gender roles, of what marriage should look like, of what a life should be, and were disappointed when Tula doesn't meet these expectations. Ian didn't even know the expectations were there. And I just think it's so important in relationships to express those expectations clearly and understand that sometimes when those expectations go unmet in your own experiences, because that other person may not even know about that. Another thing to bring out is, you know, the individual versus the collective when it comes to living out life. A lot of cultures are a lot more collectively minded. And so a marriage has to do a lot more with the community than with the individuals. And so you don't marry because of love. You marry because of social standing or convenience or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something to keep in mind when we, you know, approach other cultures. And when we approach the Bible as well, because the idea of marriage in the Bible is very different, perhaps, than the I'm getting married for love and the individualistic conception of marriage in the West today. Anyway, just wanted to say that briefly. Unfortunately, we won't get to flesh it out because we're running out of time. But that's something I wanted to add. Yeah,
one last thing I also want to say, I want to bring up a verse in Romans 12 where it's talking about relationships in general and what we ought to relate to one another. Romans 12:10 says, be devoted to one another in love, honor one another above yourselves. And I want to bring that out, that is kind of beautifully exemplified in this film, particularly in the case of Ian, where I just found it that it's very endearing that Ian kind of, you know, goes along with everything that Tula's family throws at him.
Yeah, all in.
100%. He gets baptized. He, you know, he agrees to all these, you know, these different customs, eating their food, their drink, all their, this different. It just shows just how much he really loves her and he wants to be with her and how he wants her to be honored in her family. In a sense, he doesn't want her to, you know, a lot of, I think many, in many relationships, people often try to pull themselves away from their family or kind of like pull the other away from his or her family. But here it's like you have the example of the fiance who wants her to be honored, to fulfill her parents' expectations in their own way.
Yeah. And I love...
And he never complains. He never, you know...
He's very gracious about it. He has a smile on his face and just goes along with it.
Exactly,
even when his friend makes fun of him and says, wow, so, you know, Tula's family's got you whipped, essentially. He said in another language. And then he said, so they say, jump, and you say how high, right? And then instead of him fighting back or trying to defend himself, he just kind of like playfully goes along with it. Like he's a dog, like, yeah, I'll jump kind of idea. And I love that. He's not resentful. He doesn't do it begrudgingly. He has a smile on his face. And even though it's uncomfortable maybe for his family, he's willing to do what it takes. And I love that in that process, he shows Tula, who her whole life has kind of been shown that she's... Basically, she's kind of been a little bit ashamed of her culture, it seems like. He kind of affirms her culture and affirms her as an individual, saying that, hey, you have value and your experience has value and you're worth all of that. And I love, too, how in the moment when he's getting baptized and Tula's like, I'm just worried that one day he's going to say, you're not worth all this. And her brother's like, but you are worth it, you know? And it's this idea that Ian, by being selfless and by giving of himself in this relationship, is reaffirming Tula's worth. And I think honestly, that's something that in marriage or in relationships, if we learn how to do this and champion people and see them in ways that honors them, it just kind of makes them come alive, you know? And we see that in the movie. And I think that's both biblical and powerful, idea for our society.
So I think the big takeaway from this film is build each other up in relationships, whatever relationship you have, whether it's with your parents, with your, I don't know, your fiance, your girlfriend, boyfriend, etc. It's relationships should be about building each other up, really.
Yes.
So I think that's a good note to end on. Do you have anything else to say?
Yeah, just reaffirm. You don't have to be married to be fulfilled. And you can apply these principles, like Dido said, to any relationship. And let's be honest, we all have relationships that we can apply this to. So if you feel like, hey, I'm not married, this doesn't matter, or I'm not engaged to anyone or thinking about it, hey, you can still apply these principles and this can be useful to you, because these are the principles of love. When we talk about selflessness and giving up of self and submission, this is not just marriage. So just wanted to make that clarification. I don't have anything else to add for now.
Great. So as I said, we're two, you know, guys in their 20s who are barely dipping their toes into this type of situation. I'm sure many of our older listeners would have a lot to say to us. So
please do.
And we want to hear you guys. We do want to hear you guys. So please leave your comments on our Facebook page, or you can find us on Instagram or Twitter and send us an email. What is our Twitter handle, Josias?
@CinemaTheo. That's like cinema theology without the logy. @CinemaTheo all together.
And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram @CinemaTheology. Just look that up. It should come up. And you can reach us at our email at cinematheology@gmail.com. And with that, we will see you guys later. Bye-bye.
Bye.